Today's episode is brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook. My name is Justin Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. My goal for this podcast is to have world-class experts share their story along with their hard-earned insights. Often these people are so busy perfecting their craft, they don't have a chance to pass along their lessons learned. Hopefully you can take away some actionable advice and motivation and see what it takes to become the best in the world. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I've also started a monthly newsletter where I send out a few useful or insightful things that I've found over the month. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com and clicking on the red subscribe button. My guest today is Scott Perzynski, who has traveled 23 million miles over five missions to space, including seven spacewalks. He was inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame in 2016 and is the only person to both fly into space and summit Mount Everest. Dr. Perzynski served as Senator John Glenn's personal physician during his historic return to space in 1998 and is the recipient of many awards, including five NASA Spaceflight Medals, two NASA Distinguished Service Medals, two NASA Exceptional Service Medals, the Aviation Week Laureate Award, and the Antarctica Service Medal. Here's a brief highlight from our conversation today.
So I've got to insert my feet into a couple of bindings, essentially, and then basically this 90-foot-long cobbled together robotic arm system had to fly me well away from the space station, up and over around some solar panels. So the view that I had was really a God's eye view. It's something that no one had ever seen before. It was just this perspective that I can't even do it justice. It was so amazingly beautiful.
In our conversation, we talk about what the violent journey to space is like, his historic mission to repair the space station's solar panels, and his techniques for learning a new subject. Make sure to subscribe so that you catch next month's episode with Manikshi Wadhwa, a world-class planetary scientist who is married to Scott. We dive into the world of space, as well as talk about how she and Scott met, which I'm confident is the most unique way that two human beings have run into each other. Now, without further ado, Scott Perzynski. So I wanted to talk about what that first moment is like. After you step out of the bus, you're looking at this rocket that's like a skyscraper that's going to take you to space. What is that like?
You're just thinking, oh my God, what have I got myself into? This is crazy. No, but you know, you've been training for probably 2 to 3 years getting ready for that mission. And of course, you've been dreaming about it your entire life. So it's the ultimate human experience. And so the space shuttle, which I flew on five occasions, would actually be a living, breathing organism. It was venting out of the engine bell, so there was this mist, steam emanating from the tail of the ship, and there were very, very few people around. Just the closeout crew and a few SWAT team officers with pretty heavy gear with them, and the Black Hawk helicopter flying around, and in a wider orbit, there's some F-15s kind of standing sentinel. So you realize it's a pretty serious day. And you know, when you get into that elevator, it's a rickety old elevator. You take it up to the 195-foot level. It's the slowest elevator on Earth. And you got a lot of time to think. And you know, the butterflies are building. And it's just, it's exhilarating.
And then, so what are the steps required between once you get outside of that, the bus, to actually when the engines start firing?
It's about a 2.5-hour wait. So it's hurry up and wait. The commander will be the first one on board. The flight engineer, which is a job that I had a couple of my trips into space, the last person on. So it's kind of spooky, actually, to be the flight engineer and the last one on to get strapped in. Everyone else is already on board, and you're thinking, well, what would happen if I decided, hey, guys, I don't really want to go today? a lot of things kind of go through your head. All of the people that you love the most are about 3.5 to 5 miles away in a viewing area. And you've got a rocket ship with 7 million pounds of thrust that's about to leave the planet. It gives you a lot of time to think.
How often do they end up getting scrubbed?
In the shuttle era, not infrequently. I don't know the stats, but I would imagine, you know, 30 to 40% of the time. So it's a rocket ship, of course, but it's also a winged vehicle. And so in an emergency, if we had an engine out or any kind of major malfunction, we'd have the ability to come back and land at the Kennedy Space Center, called a return to launch site abort. And if that happened, you have to have, you know, clear skies, winds less than 15 knots, crosswind. So it's got to be, you know, pretty good weather. And unfortunately, they chose the Kennedy Space Center, probably the worst part of our country, for stable weather. So every afternoon almost in Florida, there are thunderstorms that build off of the coast and come across the shuttle landing facility. So it was not always easy to take off.
What's the closest you ever came to the countdown being zero when you had to scrub?
Well, it's a great story. So I flew with this guy, maybe you've heard of him, John Glenn. And I was his, it was such a cool assignment. I was his personal physician when he returned to flight at age 77. And they needed a physician astronaut on board. And so obviously there was a lot of attention on this particular flight. The president, Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton were there, and about half of the United States Senate. And it was also a time when the tensions with Iraq were very, very high. And I remember on the launch pad, we were all strapped in and we're within an hour of launch. And the range safety officer, the RSO, came on the loops and said, the radar is saturated. And what that meant, we found out later, is that there were two or three little guys in Cessnas doing a joyride. And they wanted to get a picture of John Glenn's space shuttle. And they were flying, you know, in a very restricted airspace. And I'm sure, you know, the Black Hawk helicopters that, you know, chased them down to the ground. That was the most exciting flight they ever had.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully the 15s got there first.
Yeah, I'm sure they had a lot of attention.
What was that like to be John Glenn's doctor?
You know, it's sort of like, you know, playing basketball with Michael Jordan or soccer with Pele or, you know, doing astrophysics with Albert Einstein, being in the game with, you know, the ultimate legend in your field. And so, you know, I'd looked up to John Glenn as a kid. He was obviously a great American hero, Korean War and World War II fighter pilot, and set all sorts of aviation records, became a Mercury astronaut, served four terms in the United States Senate. So one of the greatest Americans of our time. And so it was really, I was beside myself getting a chance to fly with him. But what was really interesting about him is his humility. He, for all of his accomplishments, just wanted to be one of the crew. He didn't want any special treatment. In fact, I remember when he came into our crew office the very first time, he walked in the door and he said, if any of you guys call me Senator Glenn, I'm just going to ignore you. I'm just John or payload specialist number two. And he just, he wanted to contribute as a crew member. He didn't want any special favors. He did the routine chores aboard the shuttle just like everybody else and just admired the heck out of the guy.
And he was able to keep up in his late 70s?
He was amazing. You know, he's a Marine, very, very fit guy, even in later in life. And he walked, I think, about 5 miles a day during those times. And yeah, he was sharp as a tack to basically till his dying day. He died at age 95, I believe, about 3 years ago. And just a wonderful mind. He basically held his own on the shuttle. The only thing that really kind of set him back was his vision. So up in space, there are cubby holes and things that you have to get into, and it can be very dark and difficult to see things. So he was very clever. Within the first, I'd say, couple hours of flight, he had actually decided that he was going to have a flashlight with him on his wrist at all times. So he basically had it kind of tucked into his shirt sleeve. And every time that he needed a little extra illumination, he had it right there ready to go. And he did everything at the same pace and the same quality as any other crew member.
Does that give you hope that you might make it a six-peat going to space someday?
Yeah, I would love that. You know, John has been a role model for me my entire life, and even after he's gone, he's still a role model.
So once that clock hits zero, what is that feeling like?
You're actually on your back for about 2.5 hours, as I mentioned, building anticipation. And at T0, when the solid rocket motors ignite, it's this kick in the pants. And I'm sure it's similar to you on the flight line. You've lit your afterburners, you release the brakes, and boom, you're going someplace in a hurry. And it's just, you've got this huge grin on your face. You just hope that everybody tightened the bolts, you know, to the right torque and everything works properly. But yeah, it's just an incredible sense of acceleration. By the time you clear the launch tower, you're already going 100 miles an hour. And about 8.5 minutes later, you're going 17,500 miles an hour. It's just awesome. It's like the steepest roller coaster you've ever been on in your entire life, but it lasts for 8.5 minutes.
Is it a pretty consistent G-force, or do you feel yourself accelerating even more?
Yeah, so you leave the pad, obviously you're at 1G on your back at launch. You very quickly build up to about 2.5 Gs. And in the first stage, the first 2 minutes of the flight, we briefly get up to 2.5, close to 3 Gs. But as those white solid rocket motors would tail off and separate from the shuttle, I remember my first flight thinking, oh my God, we're going to fall out of the sky. You know, when the solid rocket motors separated, what we call staging, you kind of feel like, you know, you're falling down like a falling leaf. But then the engines will throttle up again, and you build up to about 3 Gs towards the last minute and a half of the ascent. And yeah, it's hard work. I mean, you've obviously experienced very, very high Gs, but it's probably more instantaneous on and off. Mm-hmm. And sustaining, you know, 2.5, 3 Gs for 8 minutes, you know, you're ready for the Gs to stop.
Do you have a window that you can see? Is there visual indications?
Yeah, so on the flight deck where I rode three of my flights into space, there are overhead windows right above the flight engineer seat, and it's really pretty extraordinary. You could put a mirror on your knee, and obviously you have a great view of the displays and controls in the forward flight deck, but you can look down periodically at your knee and out the overhead window. And I remember looking out, and I could see down on the beach, I could see the waves crashing on the beach beneath us, and then eventually the scattered cloud deck beneath us get further and further away, and you could see the blackness of space kind of fall upon the shuttle. It was crazy.
So you've been through one of the most violent things a human can do, 8.5 minutes, 7 million pounds of thrust. When do you finally feel like you're in space?
That main engine cutoff, or MECO, is the instant when everything goes from 3 Gs to microgravity or zero gravity. And so, you know, we're holding microphones here. The cables around the cockpit would start to float around our checklists, which would be Velcroed onto the wall. You know, maybe the Gs of ascent release the Velcro and they're on tethers, but things start to float around the cockpit. And you look out the forward windows, you see the blackness of space and the curvature of Earth beneath you. And it's an overpowering, beautiful, beautiful time.
Do you have a couple seconds to enjoy it, or are you on to the next task?
You are so task saturated. You know, every second up in space, just like flying a sortie in your F-35 is critical. You've got a job to do. And so for us, when we get into space safely, we have to reconfigure our spacecraft from a launch platform into an orbiting laboratory. So we've got to get out of we call them our pumpkin suits, the orange launch and entry suits. We've got to tear down the seats. We've got to break out all sorts of gear, reconfigure systems so that we can live in space for the next couple of weeks. So it's chaotic, you know, and so we don't really have any time to really savor the experience until maybe 2 or 3 days in.
It sounds like, you know, I had Terry Virts on here. He said your time was down to the 5 minutes, 5 minute intervals. You would have different tasks to do. So it sounds like it's an extremely busy, fast-paced environment.
It's so well choreographed. And the challenge is, especially early in flight, maybe one or two people aren't feeling well. They may have what's called space adaptation syndrome or space motion sickness. So if you lose one or two people to motion sickness, then the other people have got to kind of step up their game even more in a very dynamic time frame and do all this work so that you can, you know, safely stay on orbit and, you know, rendezvous and dock with the International Space Station or fix the Hubble or whatever it is that you're going to do. So it's very demanding. Every second of every day is kind of book kept, but it's all really exciting work. You know, the spacewalks, the robotics, the experiments, building and repairing space stations.
Yeah. What are some of the moments you're most proud of in space?
My greatest days in space were on my last mission, and it was a flight, a number at STS-120. STS stands for Space Transportation System, but that was the numeric system that we had for the space shuttle program. And we installed a new interconnecting module called Harmony to the ISS that was a node that would allow us to interconnect European and Japanese modules in the future. So that was one of the centerpieces of the mission, but the real challenging part was relocating a large solar array truss from the top of the space station using robotics and spacewalking to actually plug it into the very tip of the space station, bolt it back together, mate these electrical connectors, and unfurl these enormous solar panels. And that was if everything went per plan, but unfortunately it didn't. One of the solar panels became snagged and it began to rip apart during this evolution. And so one of the things that I really love about NASA is its capacity to take these seemingly impossible situations and come up with brilliant solutions that make it almost look easy to fix. But I can assure you this was not easy at all. We had to send a spacewalker. Turned out to be me. I was the lead spacewalker in the flight. On the end of this 90-foot-long cobbled-together robotic system along a crazy 45-minute one-way trip on the tip of this robotic arm to go suture back together this solar panel. And so it was the culmination of 72 hours of brainstorming and mission control and others around NASA to come up with a plan to solve this incredibly difficult problem. And then at the very last, send out myself and my partner, Doug Wheelock, to go effect this repair. And then Stephanie Wilson and Dan Tani inside the spacecraft were flying the robotic arm, and mission control was very actively involved. It was NASA at its very finest. And so being a part of that team and for this repair to have worked, it was definitely the finest day on the job ever for me.
And that's the furthest anybody's been from an airlock. Is that correct?
From the safety of the airlock in orbit. I think the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 17 actually traveled about 10 miles away from their lunar excursion module. But in terms of orbital flight, it was the furthest we'd ever been away. And 45-minute one-way trip out to work and 45 minutes to get back. We only had about 30 minutes of reserve oxygen in our spacesuit. And the way I like to describe this, there are times in life when you have to accept a little bit higher risk because the rewards are so important. And this was one of those days.
How did they come up with that plan, and how much input did you have?
Well, so it was people working, as I said, around the clock. They actually had a solar panel tray in Houston in one of our simulation facilities. So people were around a conference table like we're sitting at here today, with all the gear that we had aboard the Space Shuttle Space Station complex, sort of like if you've seen the movie Apollo 13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is literally an Apollo 13 situation. What can we build with the stuff that's here on this table that will allow us to fix this solar panel? And that's what took place. We had a number of video conferences with mission control. We had a lot of dialogue with them to get comfortable with the procedures. We had input. But ultimately, the highest priority was to do things in a safe manner. If it wasn't going to be possible to effect the repair in a safe manner, we would have waved off. We would have come back with a plan B or C or D, I'm sure. But plan A worked really, really well.
So what was it like getting into the airlock, getting ready to do this mission?
I always felt very well prepared for the spacewalks that I've done. I did 7 during my career, and probably a lot like you as a fighter pilot, you have the muscle memory, the years of experience, you feel confident in what your vehicle can do. And so I'd imagine 99% of the time you feel very well prepared for whatever you're going to see. This is one of those days where I didn't have the confidence that things were going to go well. In fact, I gave it maybe a 75% chance of success in terms of fixing the damage, but a close to 100% chance of doing it safely. And that's the culture that we had at NASA. And so I definitely had a lot of butterflies when I floated out the hatch that day. That was a very different work environment for sure.
And then how do you get from the airlock to the solar panels?
Yeah, so it was a crazy thing. We had to set up a boot plate, essentially. Imagine sort of like a snowboard that's been grappled by the end of the robotic arm. So we've got it plugged into the end of this robotic arm. So I've got to insert my feet into a couple of bindings, essentially. And then basically this 90-foot-long cobbled-together robotic arm system had to fly me well away from the space station, up and over around some solar panels. So the view that I had was really a god's eye view. It's something that no one had ever seen before. It was just this perspective that I can't even do it justice. It was so amazingly beautiful. And so Stephanie and Dan had to fly me safely around these other live solar panels and keep me safe as well as not damaging the space station. And then once I got to the worksite, I couldn't have any direct contact with the solar panel. If I did, potentially there could be electricity arcing into my spacesuit. So I had my metal wrist disconnects on my spacesuit insulated with Kapton tape. And I had another tool that I called a hockey stick, about, 2 feet in length in the shape of an L that I could use to safely keep the solar panel from, floating into me. And I had to install what we call cufflinks, essentially pieces of wire with small pieces of aluminum shim stock that have been cut to allow me to kind of insert it through holes in the solar panel so that we could eventually unfurl this enormous solar wing. So I had a lot of time to think on the way to work that day.
And you can't just turn off a solar panel, right? Were you doing most of it in the dark at night?
No. In fact, even in orbital night, when you're behind the Earth in shadow, the solar panels are generating lots and lots of electricity. So even in Earth shadow, I could have been electrocuted. So I had to be very, very careful around the clock, so to speak. And we had so much work to do that we had to work right on through even the peak illumination during orbital day.
Wow, that's incredible. So I know one of your expertise specialties is the physiology of the human body in space. So how does the human body react to being in space?
You know, it's interesting that the human body is so adaptable. It's amazing when we think about what humans are capable of. You know, you look at triathletes and people that climb all the 8,000 meter peaks on Earth without supplemental oxygen. You know, the athletic and cognitive abilities of humans is just amazing. It's really neat how easily we adjust to space flight. You know, going from Earth's one gravity to floating around in space is really easy on the body. It's sort of like floating on top of a pool on a float, or if you're a scuba diver or a snorkeler and you have that sense of neutral buoyancy where you don't sink to the bottom or float to the top. That's what it's really like. Your body kind of goes on holiday. Your heart doesn't have to pump against gravity. Your muscles and bones don't have to resist it either. And so that's all well and good. There is a problem initially going into space. Your inner ear has a tough time in the absence of gravity. It gives you this signal, you know, it's very confused. And so it can cause motion sickness, nausea, and vomiting for the first couple of days in space. But after you get past that, it's pretty easy living and working in space. But if you don't do anything, your muscles and bones and your heart will actually atrophy. And it could be a very, very significant issue, especially if you're up there for months at a time. My friend Scott Kelly was up there for 340 days, and he exercised 2 or more hours every day just to kind of break even. But your body is basically wasting away. And so we have to lift weights. We have to keep our cardiovascular system, you know, working out. So we have bike ergometers, rowing ergometers, and we can't take a full gym with weights up with us because weights would have obviously no meaning. So we have electromechanical and hydraulic systems that give us resistance to keep our bodies fit.
Wow. So for long-term space travel, do you see issues? Have we solved most of the issues in terms of that?
Unfortunately, no, we haven't. I really think it's the ultimate human destiny to send astronauts to Mars. And in fact, I think we ought to colonize Mars. We ought to also have an outpost on the moon. And I think that that's going to happen really soon. Maybe some of our listeners are going to be part of those first crews, which would be really exciting. But the challenges are pretty significant. So a couple things that are most concerning to me. Our long-duration astronauts are experiencing really significant changes in their vision. There's an increased intracranial pressure that's developing for reasons that we don't yet understand, but it's changing the shape of the back of the eyeball, and astronauts are coming back with pretty significant deterioration of their vision. So scientists are really looking at fixing that problem. But the bigger problem, perhaps, is the radiation environment. When we were up in Earth orbit, you know, aboard the International Space Station or the Mir Space Station, where I also visited, we're protected by the Earth's magnetic field. Our planet is basically a huge magnet. And what that does is it actually protects us from the sun's cosmic, there's galactic cosmic radiation and then coronal mass ejections from the sun. So it's a high radiation environment. And so in Earth's environment, we actually have some protection from that radiation. When you go to the moon or a longer duration mission to Mars, you're much more exposed to even acute radiation sickness and of course, over the long haul, a much higher risk of cancers. So we need to figure out either better ways to shield our spacecraft or radioprotective medicines, perhaps, that would allow us to weather a major solar storm. And then I think when we start to really live on the moon and Mars, we're going to have to build our habitats beneath the surface to build as much shielding around those habitats.
So are we close to solving any of those problems? I know Elon Musk's, you know, has some ambitious timelines. Are we, even if he can get us there with a rocket, are we close to solving those problems?
Well, I don't think Elon Musk is doing it the right way, and I admire the heck out of him, and I love his vision for, you know, trying to colonize Mars. He wants to send 100 people at a time to build habitats there, build a society there, which Earth 2.0, which I think would be wonderful. However, the challenge with a big chemical rocket is you're exposed for many months in this interplanetary space, which could prove fatal. So the way that I think we should be really planning on going to Mars is by use of a different system. It's called Vasimir. It's a, not to get too nerdy here, but it's a plasma ion engine that allows you to have continuous acceleration all the way out to Mars. You can get there much, much quicker. You could actually have ferries going back and forth all the time. But the cool thing about it would be powered by three nuclear reactors kind of around the crew compartment. And those nuclear reactors, not only do they provide the power to get there, but they would actually generate a magnetic field that would shield the crew on that long transit. So that's the way I think we ought to be thinking about deep space travel.
How does that cut down? The number I've heard is 18 months. Is that accurate for a chemical rocket?
Probably about nine months each way, and then you would spend, you know, 3 to 4 months there, or you would have to wait until the planets were co-aligned again. So it might become a 2.5 to 3 year mission.
Wow. And then what about the new rocket engine, the Vasimir?
Vasimir, yeah. So you could potentially get there in about, I think, 70 to 90 days.
Oh, wow.
So much faster. And you, if there was an emergency on your way out there, you could actually turn the ship around and come back to Earth, which is something that a chemical rocket couldn't do.
So if you were to put a timeline on when you think we're going to get to Mars, probably not the 2020s, 2030s?
I think so. What's missing right now is the national or international imperative. And I hope we get that. America's always been at its strongest when we take on the bold challenges. And so obviously in our heritage in the space program, John F. Kennedy's challenge to get us to the moon in this decade and return the crew safely to Earth, that was such a galvanizing sort of a vision. I think there are lots of things that our collective mindset could do, not only in space, but in terms of curing disease and dealing with, you know, climate change and other things. And I hope we focus on some of those things.
Do you think we change the format? I mean, it seems really like an exciting time right now with Blue Origin, SpaceX, yeah, all these commercial enterprises. Do you see NASA kind of changing a little bit so that we're now, or NASA's now pairing up with these guys?
I think it's the right thing to do. You know, it's sort of the commercial barnstorming era of spaceflight, right? So, you know, back in the early part of the last century, you know, a guy would come into your village with a biplane and for a quarter would take you for a tour around your hometown, and then he or she would fly off to the next town. And right now we've got Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin. They're going to be taking tourists up for short suborbital hops. But in the not too distant future, I would hope within, you know, 5 to 10 years, there'll be orbiting space hotels. It'll be expensive initially, but ultimately it'll be something that through economies of scale, we'll be able to send thousands of people to these different types of environments, both for vacations, but also for work. So I think that's really exciting. And so it's kind of the advent of commercial human spaceflight right now. And I would hope that NASA will take on the challenge of doing the more difficult things. You know, how are we going to really live off the land on the South Pole of the moon? How can we develop the technologies that will allow us to thrive and survive on Mars? How can we go even beyond? You know, there are places in our solar system that are fascinating. Europa, Enceladus, and Titan are these ice-encrusted moons of our outer gas giant planets. And so these ice-crusted planets actually have oceans beneath them. So wouldn't it be amazing if we could go there and bore through the ice and maybe we'd find the Loch Ness Monster, or maybe we'd find, you know, single-cell life. I mean, I really think that, you know, life exists elsewhere in the universe. It probably doesn't look anything like us, but it would change everything if we could really try to, you know, make those types of discoveries.
And you think the key is going to the moon first?
I think the right stepping stone is to go to the moon. If we were to send a crew to Mars right now, you know, it's many months of exposure and risk when we haven't really perfected all the habitat technology. How do you create the life support systems that can survive in a high dust environment? You know, if you're on the moon, you're 3 days away from home. You could get back in an emergency. If you're out, you know, look at poor Matt Damon. if you're stuck there home alone, there's no guarantee that anyone's going to be able to rescue you. So I think we have a lot more to learn on our own moon.
He seems to do that a lot.
He does, doesn't he? He always gets picked for those missions.
So switching gears a little bit, one of the things that really stood out reading about your childhood was that you grew up in West Africa and the Middle East. What was the backstory behind that, and how did that alter or change your perspective on life?
It changed everything, quite honestly. I think anytime we travel, we meet new people, we have new adventures, it just kind of opens your aperture to wonderful things. My parents were very adventurous. I was an only child, so it gave them the flexibility to kind of pick up and move when I was a kid. So at the end of the Apollo program, my father was an engineer on NASA's Apollo program. They were looking to diversify. Boeing Airplane Company was looking to diversify, and they needed representatives in West Africa. So sure, why not? Let's go do that. And so I spent my junior high school years in Dakar, Senegal. Learned to speak French. I had African kids to play with, and very cross-cultural kind of an environment. I then ended up living in Beirut, Lebanon for a little bit, Tehran, Iran, a place where we Americans can't even go right now, which is really kind of disappointing that the world has turned the way it has. And then I graduated high school in Athens, Greece. And so, just that ability to see the world and experience new cultures also opened up my perspective. I recognize that some of life's greatest adventures and lessons come from outside the classroom. It's who you meet, the opportunities that you take along the way.
Is there anything growing up that really shaped you and altered the trajectory of where you were going in life?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. No one's ever asked me that. Generically, the travels were transformative. I think living in a couple of war-torn areas, when we were in Beirut, Lebanon, this was in the mid-70s, it was the beginning of the civil war there, we had to evacuate. And we lost a bunch of our belongings. A bit later, in the late 70s, we were in Tehran, Iran, and we lost the rest of our belongings. So we didn't have a lot of luck there. We were in a couple of very dynamic, evolving environments. But what I think that taught me is just to savor the opportunities, to see as much as I could. And also, I think it probably taught me a little bit about self-preservation. You know, living in an environment where you are living in a war zone, it's something that we as Americans don't have any real perspective on. But I think it definitely made me more observant and a better traveler, I guess.
Did you know you wanted to be an astronaut when you were young?
I did. Yeah. So ever since I could walk and talk, I suppose I wanted to be an astronaut. I had model rockets and posters on the wall, and the opportunity to see Apollo 9 launch. That was the first mission of the lunar excursion module in Earth orbit, and got a chance to watch that from the beach at Cocoa Beach, Florida. And my destiny was set at that point, I think.
Were you sure you're going to be an astronaut? Because it seems like you went through kind of a non-standard path, not going through test school, instead going to medical school.
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to pursue medicine as well. I had this ambition to help people, and I saw that as a pathway. As I was going through high school and my early college years, they were actually hiring the first group of shuttle astronauts, which included a number of physician astronauts. So I knew that they'd be doing more and more medical research. So I saw an avenue to go do that. I'd have to admit, though, at one point in my life, I really seriously considered naval aviation, in fact. But in those days, you had to decide your junior year of high school. You had to do some sort of a physical fitness qualification test. And then also I was living in Greece, so I didn't have any access to a congressman or woman to nominate me for the academy. So one thing led to another, and I ended up approaching the space program through medicine.
So in addition to going to medical school, being an astronaut, going into space 5 times, you've also climbed Mount Everest. I guess, why did you do that? And then what kind of lessons did you learn doing that?
Well, as a lot of people would probably say, not the brightest thing I've ever done. You know, it is an incredibly challenging and inherently unsafe thing to do. But as a climber, you know, from my teens, actually, the more you climb, the stronger your skills become. And the more you read about expeditionary mountaineering, the lure of Mount Everest kind of draws you in. And so I had read every, you know, classic mountaineering book that had ever been written. And as I took my first shuttle flight in 1994, I took this classic shot flying directly over the top of Mount Everest. To this day, I'm obviously a little bit biased, but I think it's the best photograph of Everest ever taken from space. But looking straight down on the summit without a cloud in the sky over the Himalayas, and I had this blow-up of the mountain over my desk for many years, and I started to daydream. What would it look like to not only see it from this vantage point, but to see it with my own boot prints right there on top of the world? And so I continued to climb. I continued to strengthen my skills. And so in 2008, I had my first attempt on the mountain. Unfortunately, about 2 months into that first expedition, I ruptured a disc in my low back at about 24,000 feet above sea level. Not a good place to get injured. So I had to hobble down. No one can carry you down from those altitudes. It's under your own power, or you're going to be an icicle there forever. So I was highly motivated to get down. And once I got home, I needed to have disc surgery. I had a lumbar disc that had popped out. So once that was repaired, I got back in the gym and set my sights on returning. And the following springtime, on May 20th, 2009, at 4 a.m. local time, I was able to top out on Mount Everest. And it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my life. And the reason being, the things that come to us, the most difficult challenges overcome are the things that mean the most to us. I think if I had made it to the top my first attempt, it would have been a wonderful, memorable experience. But the fact that I had to struggle my way back, had to spend another 2 months in the mountain to acclimatize and make it up to the top of the world, that gives me such incredible strength now. Whenever I have to face a really difficult challenge, I think back to that time of overcoming the hurdles to get to the top of the world and back. Yeah, I was very focused, even and especially on my first attempt on Mount Everest, to make it a round trip. It doesn't really count unless you make it a round trip. So I when I went back in 2009, I knew that I had the right framework, the right mindset. I would do the right thing. If it wasn't safe, I wouldn't go for the summit. But I made it, and I knew that I would, for the rest of my life, use the same sort of approach of, you know, being tenacious, but also being well-prepared and doing the right thing, putting my team first, not jeopardizing their safety, not putting them in a life or death situation trying to rescue me. I knew that I'll do the right thing.
It seems like a little bit of a different environment. NASA, you have this whole team behind you. They're monitoring you. It's risky, but you can kind of phone a friend if you want. Climbing Everest kind of seems risky as well, but you don't really have quite that support network. Is that the feeling that you got?
Well, to a degree, yeah. So when you're on the side of Mount Everest, you feel the life threat every second of every day. You're cold, hypoxic, dehydrated, malnourished. You know, you're in the elements. When you're aboard the International Space Station or a space shuttle, you're wearing a polo shirt like this. It's room temperature, really comfortable. You only feel the life threat on launch and landing, or maybe when you're out on a spacewalk. So it's a different kind of mindset. But going out on a spacewalk and going for the summit of Everest, actually, there are a lot of corollaries. Even though you have mission control in your ear on a spacewalk, it's only you and your buddy out there. If you have a significant malfunction in your spacesuit, you've got a leak or, you know, a battery problem or a short, either you crawl yourself back, or he or she who's out there with you has got to drag you back in, and maybe, you know, your oxygen supply won't make it. So, you know, there's a level of commitment that you feel out on a spacewalk, and certainly on summit morning when you crawl out of the vestibule of your tent, it's pitch black. You've got a helmet light on. You've got big boots and gloves on. You're clipping into fixed lines, kind of like clipping in to do a spacewalk. You've got an oxygen system on your face. You definitely feel like you're in another world. It's pretty crazy.
One of the skills it looks like that you've mastered is learning well. So when you see a new task, how do you go about learning how to do that?
That's a great question. And I have a couple of points I wanted to make on that. One of the things I'd recommend to our listeners is not only to dream big, but to think about it in achievable steps along that path. So if you want to become a fighter pilot or an astronaut or a politician or whatever that lofty goal is that you want to achieve, there are things that you can do along the way that will prepare you for the next step and the next step and the next step. And if you can have achievable successes along the way, even if you don't follow that direct linear path, wonderful things are going to happen. You're going to become stronger, more capable. Other doors will open for you. And so I like to think about success as a series of achievable goals and successes. And you've always kept that long-term goal out there. And so for me, I learned that actually as a Boy Scout. I went through and became an Eagle Scout. A lot of people get discouraged and they realize that, well, it's going to take 2.5, 3, 4 years. I'll never get there. But if you treat it as one Barrett badge at a time, one rank at a time, one service project at a time, the successes along the pathway reinforce your confidence and allow you to get to your summit. So, whatever that summit in life is. And then, I'm sorry, the other question had, the bulk of your question had to do with how do you prepare? And for me, it's all about not only preparing for success or planning on success, but preparing for failures along the way. So when you're preparing to do a spacewalk, it's not the procedures that you've always trained to do, but understanding how things are supposed to work and how they might fail, and then thinking it through, what would happen if this failure happened at this time? Do I have a plan B or a plan C? And that kind of rigor is something that was sort of drilled into us at NASA. Take, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope, knowing how every electron in that space telescope works, how every bit of data, how every photon that's being collected, what's that wiring diagram look like? Understanding it inside and out, and what if this box breaks here? What can we do? What happens if this other thing also breaks? Really understanding in depth how things work and how they fail gives you the confidence to succeed. And so I took my Everest expeditions in that same mindset. I was incredibly well prepared physically, but also mentally, technically. My teammates around me were very, very strong. And so it's a mindset that's carried with me through everything that I've done. And I'm sure it's something that you can relate to as an aviator.
Right. Some of the things, that I see, understanding that why behind, what you're doing. It kind of, to me, I picture a tree and the leaves are the little bits of information. But if you don't have that trunk, you just have a bunch of leaves just blowing, right, blowing in the wind. So finding that why behind what you're doing helps.
Yeah, how it's all rooted together. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So when you have those little steps, are they very tangible for those little steps that you're taking?
Absolutely. They've got to be tangible, measurable, and meaningful to you personally. So mountains are a wonderful metaphor for life, and it's easy to describe it. But I remember arriving at Everest Base Camp, and the summit is 2 vertical miles above you. Base Camp is at 17,500 feet, and it's still a long, long way to the top of the world, and it's really challenging terrain. And there are a number of climbers who will arrive at base camp, take a look at the mountain, and turn around. They realize that there's no way that they can stay there for 2 months and work their way up the mountain. And so you have to break it down into a week at a time, a day at a time, even a rope length at a time, or even a footstep at a time on summit day. And if you can kind of celebrate the victories, making it up to camp one that first time, you're exhausted and it's taken you a long, long time to get there. You spend a night or two and you come back down to base camp and you rest for a week. But the next time you go up, you do it a whole lot faster. You feel a whole lot more comfortable. You'll go up to camp two and spend a couple of nights, then come back to base camp and rest for another week, and then you'll take a rotation up to camp three, progressively going higher in the mountain. And so as you're going through this evolution, you do get stronger, not only physically, but mentally.
Do you find that you are very routine-based? Like, is your day broken up pretty structure?
No, I would love to have a routine that I could look to, but I think I really enjoy challenges along the way, and I do like variety. But I, you know, life is unscripted, and right now I run a tech startup company, and there's so many different surprises that happen in the setting of building a new company and a new technology and a new industry as we're trying to do. So, you know, that part is fun, but it's also stressful and challenging at times too.
Is there anything that you do throughout the day that helps you to be more productive or to perform at a better, higher level?
Two things, coffee and working out. So if I get really busy on travel or something and I can't work out for a week, it affects my performance. I know it. So for me, it's really important to stay both physically but also mentally sharp.
What kind of workouts do you typically do?
Well, so my wife and I travel a lot between Phoenix and Houston. So we were members of Orange Theory Fitness. So we like circuit training. And then if there's a chance to get outside, hiking and kind of stressing ourselves in the vertical world is great too.
Yeah. So you've also, like you mentioned, started a startup, Fluidity Technology.
Right.
Can you talk to what was the why you started that and what you're doing there?
Yeah, so I had these wonderful experiences in space, and I'm not as experienced a pilot as you, but I've flown some pretty cool airplanes and flown robotic arms and virtual reality simulators and computer games and worked in this three-dimensional realm for much of my life. And when I came back from space and I retired from the space program for a time, I was a chief technology officer at a medical research institute. And I started to get really interested in surgical robotics and these Da Vinci surgical robots that are amazing. The surgeon will sit 10 to 15 feet away from their patient and using this really complicated interface, work inside the human body and do amazing things. And so in skilled hands, it's really remarkable that the healing time is much quicker and the outcomes can be really quite exceptional. But if they aren't done by really skilled hands, people who are very, very proficient, the outcomes are not nearly as good. It's sort of like if you were to stop flying for 6 months mm-hmm. and step back to the jet, you would have a tough time.
Even a week.
Yeah, right, yeah. That proficiency, the muscle memory goes. And so I realized that having worked in this extraordinary realm of space, a unique way to move a point of reference, whether it's a camera or the tip of a surgical instrument or the nose of a drone, with great precision. And so I invented a technology that's the core of our company, and we're now distributing a product called the FT Aviator. And so it's a remarkably more intuitive and more precise way to move a drone through the sky. The way that they're currently operated is sort of like an Xbox controller, two sticks. Mm-hmm. These things have been around since the 1930s, actually, for radio-controlled aircraft. We've had no innovation in over eight decades. And so now we're able to make it possible for a five-year-old kid within 5 minutes to be flying a perfect figure eight or an orbit, something that would take an experienced pilot, hundreds of hours to really master. So we've unlocked some really cool human potential with our technology.
It obviously has applications past just a drone. I mean, we spend a lot of time learning. We call it the piccolo drill with our controls. We have so many buttons on there.
Right.
Foresee this moving into a lot of different fields like that?
Absolutely. I'm so excited to hopefully get this into a fly-by-wire helicopter. And there are also these basically individual drones, multi-rotor craft that you could have in your garage and you could commute to work, sort of like the Jetsons, which is probably predates you by quite a bit. But these aircraft that could be zipping around the sky and direct line of flight to wherever you need to get to. So there are lots of different applications for this technology, whether in surgical robotics, in ROVs under the ocean, virtual and augmented reality, industrial cranes, you name it. Anything that moves through physical or virtual space will be able to really benefit.
It seems like moving into the startup domain, that's a big jump from what you were doing before. What kind of lessons learned have you learned from running a startup?
A lot of people ask me, what's the hardest thing I've ever done? You know, become an astronaut or the summit Mount Everest? And I'll tell them neither. The toughest thing I've ever done is a tech startup. and I'm saying that only partly in jest. I mean, it really is a difficult thing. I'm an inventor. That's probably my strongest capability, but that's the easiest part really of bringing a new product to market. There are a lot of great ideas out there, but it's all execution after that. It's assembling the team. It's the fundraising. It's the marketing. It's the manufacturing. It's the million and one details that you would have never thought about. And so I've been very fortunate to bring on board my team some great people. It's almost more important who you work with than what you're working on. I don't know if you've found that in your life, but you know, one bad character can really mess up the entire experience for everyone. And so really taking time to recruit the best team, to have a mission that everyone can get behind. And then you just have to be tenacious. And so I don't know where I am in terms of the from base camp to summit on my startup, but you know, it's a long, arduous path. We've overcome some hurdles. We've got a really wonderful product that's getting better all the time. And so I'm really excited about its potential to perhaps even one day teleoperate. You could have a surgeon here in Phoenix delivering surgical care in sub-Saharan Africa or rural Nepal or rural North Dakota, places even in our own country where we don't have the surgeons or clinicians to be able to deliver the highest quality of care in remote parts of our planet. So that's my long-term lofty goal.
And in addition to that, what other projects are you working on? I think I read that you are the chief adventurist of ASU. Is that? Oh, I didn't even know that was a real job.
Yeah. Well, I used to have a position at ASU where my wife currently works. So I was titled the University Explorer. And that was a great couple of years that I spent at ASU. It's such an amazing university, how it's focused not on who it can exclude, but you know, the performance of all who come through the doors. It's about, you know, impact. And I think that they've really rethought education in some powerful ways. And so my wife actually is the director of the School of Earth and Space Exploration called CSE at ASU. And, you know, it's such a cutting edge, wonderful school and leading in innovation and all sorts of things.
Is there anything on your short-term bucket list that you want to do?
Tons of things. Not all of them are really exotic kinds of things. My ultimate goal would be to do what I call the exploration trifecta, which is space, Everest, and the Marianas Trench, Challenger Deep. So that would be wonderful if I could get down there someday. It's almost harder to get to the bottom of the ocean than it is to get to the backside of the moon. It's, you know, the extreme pressures at 11,000 meters beneath the ocean. It's only, I guess, four people in human history have done it.
Wow. That was in the 70s, right? Or it was a long time ago.
I think the 60s, and then James Cameron did it perhaps 10 years ago. And then just earlier this year, another explorer from Dallas repeated the feat. In fact, he did a really remarkable expedition called the Five Deeps. He took a newly engineered craft to the Five Deeps, he called it, but the bottom of the five oceans, the deepest parts of our planet's oceans, the first time in recorded history. So pretty remarkable.
So are you plugged in with the submersible field? Are you is that how you're going to, or are you going to build your own submarine?
Well, I can't afford that, but no, I am plugged in with the ocean exploration crowd. And in fact, there's so much about our planet's oceans that we don't understand. You may have heard the stat, but we've only mapped in any significant detail less than 5% of our ocean floor. And we know even less about what's happening in the water column above. And of course, we're not being great stewards of our ocean right now. The trash gyres that are in the oceans, the plastic that's accumulating, the coral bleaching, the overfishing. So we have a crisis on our hands that we need to address. And so I'd like to help be part of the science and the solution for that. But yeah, so I've piloted a couple of submersibles, and that's pretty cool thing to do. And I'd love to kind of do more of that in the future.
And you're also going to, what, the North Pole in the next couple of months? That's not just a drive to Tucson for most people.
Well, next summer, I believe, we'll be heading up there as part of a scientific expedition. So that'll be really exciting. I've never been that far north, so... And especially with the way that, you know, the planet is changing, to get a chance to see that would be really important.
And where can people keep up with you and follow along with your journey?
Yeah, so I'd love for people to check out my website. It's a tough last name. Parazynski.com is my website, Parazynski. And then the Twitter handle, which is AstroDocScott. So Twitter and Instagram, I'm out there. And if you're interested in flying drones or just want to learn more about Fluidity, fluidity.tech is our website. And it's, I tell you, flying drones is just so much fun. But when you get out there with an FT aviator, you feel like a fighter pilot, even though you're on the ground, stuck on the ground. It gives you a tactile sense of what's happening on board your drone. You've got a real-time video feed of what the drone is seeing. And you can maneuver your aircraft with incredible precision. So it's a lot of fun, and I think the future of flying drones.
Well, Scott, sir, thanks for coming on the podcast. This has been awesome.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to review it. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I've also started a monthly newsletter where I send out a few useful or insightful things that have helped me over the last month. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com and clicking on the red subscribe button. The link to the newsletter is also in the show notes. Today's episode was brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.